What's up, everyone? We're back for another episode of Red Receipt. Red Receipt is a podcast by Antidote, the email and SMS marketing agency by people who hate boring email. It's a deep dive into the how and why of the brands we love and the creatives behind them. From blueprints to launch day, customers as community, and the detours in between. As always, I'm your host, Sean Donovan, tuning in with another special guest on the show today. Joining us today on the podcast, we're lucky enough to sit down with two brand builders from the beauty world, the sister-in-law duo behind Goldfaden MD, Lauren and Lisa Goldfaden. What is now a line of natural, technologically advanced skincare solutions, Goldfaden MD began with the formulas created by Lisa's father in his nearly 40-plus year career in dermatology. The company itself was founded officially in 2013, but most of the actual formulas have been in use by Dr. Gary Goldfaden's patients for decades. They join us here on the show to talk traditions, a medically engineered product, and the inspiration Dr. Goldfaden held. We're super excited to have them and hope you enjoy the show. To start out, I'd love to learn a little bit more about both of your backgrounds before launching the brand and kind of the original idea behind the brand and how that came to be.
Sure. Well, my background and original reason for being involved in this is that my father is Dr. Goldfaden. So I grew up, he's a doctor. My mother was a nurse. We grew up in a very medical based type of, you know, household, and also raised, in a very naturally focused way, meaning, you know, back in the 80s and late 70s, you know, it was more in vogue, I think, for adults maybe that were coming out of like the hippie generation to be really into health food. I mean, this is a long time ago, and now it sort of seems funny to talk about, oh, I would never give my kid, you know, X, Y, and Z. But then, you know, kids are drinking Coke and eating candy, and, you know, my parents were very strict with us, and that really came, you know, out of my father. So I kind of grew up in this. It's not surprising that I ended up doing this eventually, even though I had a whole other career before, but I kind of grew up under this umbrella of health and wellness. But before I was doing this, I was in education. I did my undergraduate at University of Denver, where I, my degree is in art history and studio art. And I was, my focus was in printmaking. And then from there, I really wanted to do something that was involved in the art, but also be able to, you know, make a living and have a job. And being a studio artist, as much as I loved that, certainly wasn't necessarily the path that I thought was the best one for me to take. So I decided to go back to graduate school and have a master's in museum education with childhood ed as well. So I did that in New York City at Bank Street, which is a very progressive elementary school for children, but they also have an incredible graduate program. So I did that. And from there, I went to work at the museum. It's called the, you probably know because you're in LA, the Paley Museum, which originally used to be called the Museum of Television and Radio, I believe it was, before they changed the name. So I went and worked there for a year, developing curriculum for, you know, ages, kindergarten all the way through high school, utilizing their archive, which was, if you haven't, you probably have, because I feel like I'm talking your language, but they have an incredible archive of everything going back to like the days of radio all the way up through, you know, public service announcements, like those amazing ones we all watched when we were kids. I mean, they have like every sitcom, we did an entire curriculum on like the Vietnam War, and there was all this news footage, you know, that you know, I wasn't even born yet. So, you know, seeing it for the first time is pretty incredible. And then from there, I went on to teach in both the public school system and the private school system in New York City. And then I was like, enough of that. Let's do something challenging. And yeah, then that's like the whole story into the brand. But I'll let Lauren talk about her background.
What a drastic career change.
Yeah, well, it is drastic. However, I tend to handle a lot of our training programs. It's like I used to say, well, I always taught little kids, and now it's sort of like I'm teaching adults. So in a lot of ways, it prepared me very well for this. I feel like if you can work with little kids, you can kind of do anything because they're the most difficult, like that's the most challenging. Like adults are a walk in the park after, you know, first.
Yeah. Grade. I also feel like sales is a lot of education based.
Yes, for sure.
Ideas. For
sure. All education and most people, even though I think we want to think our skin savvy, And there is a huge bucket of men and women who understand skincare and know how to use it, but the majority of people just, they truly don't understand. And so there is so much education that goes behind, you know, a simple product that's on a shelf or available online. It really needs to be taught.
Totally. And what is your background?
My goodness. Well, my background is in advertising and marketing. So I actually graduated at Barry University in South Florida with a marketing and advertising degree. And I went to go work at Crispin Porter and Bogusky, which at the time was the biggest advertising agency in the world. And I was so grateful to be there because it was just, we were on fire, and I worked on accounts like Burger King and Coca-Cola and Volkswagen. And so really had this diverse sort of range and background into advertising. And if you guys have not seen the masterclass or sort of dived into this new masterclass that's available, it's so intriguing and interesting. And I was watching something the other day with, a big advertising agency talking about sort of how they've had to pivot from traditional advertising to digital. And it was just so fascinating. And it made me realize, you know, I was there in the early 2000s. And when we were working on advertising campaigns, it was television and radio and billboard and print magazines. And the digital business was like minuscule because it hadn't evolved yet. So, anyway, that was my background. And I had a little bit of experience in beauty because we ended up launching Method Home Care into Target. And that was their first partner when they first launched in 2004. And so my team was heavily involved in the marketing, the launch strategy, but also had a heavy hand in the creative aspect of it. And those teardrop bottles were sort of, that was their claim to fame. And I just loved it. It was like, I had a little bit of beauty amongst, you know, working on these sort of a little bit more macho type campaigns with, you know, automotive and fast food and Coca-Cola. So I just loved it. And I'll let Lisa sort of tell the story. But so that was my background. I worked on every aspect of the creative aspect. I was sort of the in production and managing the different facets that client relations to production and internal services.
It's also interesting launching something like Method. Working for such a large agency was probably interesting to get a look into a smaller.
It was. And it's funny that you bring that up, Sean, because at the time, the only reason I believe we brought Method on was because it was like a friend of one of the partners. They truly believed in this concept. It was a startup, sort of well beyond these startup phases. And within this, the space that they were launching in was really innovative. I mean, natural, clean, laundry and cleaning care was, there was one other brand on the market. So it was so exciting to be part of this huge movement, which now has gotten much bigger, but at the time was truly groundbreaking. And it was so incredible to be part of that, that initial launch of that brand.
Yeah, I also remember the bottle shape and all of the acclaim that they got after the bottle shape and launching in Target.
Oh, they won all sorts of awards and all of that. So so that was my little slice of beauty.
That's awesome. What a fun project.
And I'll let Lisa tell the story of the brand and how we sort of we came about that and how I got, you know, brought in. So I'll defer to you.
I'm the lucky one. I'll put it that way. I think that she got brought into our life through like magic of the universe. And I could not ask for a more intelligent, incredibly innovative, hardworking partner. So, I mean, her background coming from where she came from, like her, that background was and still is imperative, I think, and for our success. I mean, really bringing in tools that I certainly didn't have. And she just, it was kind of, I think we had a home run because of that, you know? So
I would love to hear how you guys got started working together in general and then also on the brand. I love the idea of taking the experience from a larger agency launching brands, and just, I'm super curious about the learnings that you took from that into launching this brand, but I'd love to hear the story too.
Yeah, definitely. So, how Lauren and I came to work together, and then I will tell you the full brand story and that will then make sense. But so she and I are sister-in-laws, which I think you know, but she, is married to my brother, who we also work together as well. And being a true family business, you know, I got lucky enough to have like a best friend, a work partner, and a sister-in-law, like all in one. And it wasn't always, you know, she was not, obviously always, we knew each other before, we knew each other in our other careers. She was in our lives, you know, before we decided to do this, but, thank goodness she was. So our brand story really starts, you know, with my dad. He has been a practicing dermatologist for almost 50 years now. He's semi-retired now and really focuses more on our brand and our formulation and the education piece and research. But you know, he had his practice for many, many years, as I said, in South Florida, in Hollywood, Florida. If you know where that is, it's about 20 minutes north of Miami. And he, you know, because he's been in dermatology for so long, before the days that we have now of this sort of cosmetic dermatology, dermatologists used to, before that, really primarily were caring for diseases of the skin, treating diseases of the skin, and that could range anything from, particularly in Florida, skin cancer, sun damage, removal of moles, rashes, I mean, what have you. And he would treat patients from, you know, babies all the way up through, you know, 90 years old. So he really saw, you know, a great, I think, patient, you know, group when it came to different issues, different skin issues, different ages, different everything. So one thing about my father is that, as I mentioned, he is a real health freak and a real nature nut when it comes to not only what you're eating, what you're putting in your body, but also what you're putting on your body. Obviously, being a doctor and a dermatologist, this is something that he has always been incredibly interested in and developed this, you know, really kind of cult following with his practice because he really treated his patients, and when he still treats certain patients, in a 360 sort of mentality, right? So it's not just okay, great, you have this mole or you have this sun damage and we're going to burn it off or da 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 da. It's also kind of like, okay, let's look at like what you're washing your clothes with, what you're eating, what you like, it's look at everything, because health is not just this or whatever. It's kind of all inclusive. So he had always been interested in health, wellness, food, ingredients, plants, nature, things of that nature. And he was quite frustrated within the practice. I would say this is like now getting into like the late 1970s, early 1980s, with topical products that were available for his patients. So, right, like what would happen? Someone would come in, this is an example, they would maybe be suffering from acne. There weren't a lot of options then on what you could give someone. You could prescribe them an antibiotic. Great. Okay. You could give them something that came from a big drug company. Okay, great. But then, you know, you got to look at the list of, you know, all the ingredients that are in there. And he was finding that there wasn't enough or any really products to deliver kind of this clean effect. And when I talk about clean back in 1980, it's a very different meaning than it has like today in 2020, right? Today, most brands aren't formulating with a lot of the bad things that we used to see in the formulations, right? But originally, when he was kind of concocting this whole thing and concocting these products just for his patients, he was more worried about what the ingredients were topically doing to the skin, right? So like something as simple as, you know, red dye number 12, again, I'm making that up, that was causing people to have, you know, atopic dermatitis, rashes, it was aggravating their eczema. So he started to formulate products, problem solution products for his patients, really out of a frustration of not being able to find those to give to the patients or to prescribe to the patients. Then the aha moment really is when, so again, back in the early 1980s, microdermabrasion, in-office microdermabrasion became extremely popular in practices. And that is a procedure you can have in office where it's removing basically the dead skin cells off the surface of the skin. So that's taking off any sort of like sun damage, darkness, you know, what have you. And it became very popular. And at the time, they were, let me try to say it in layman terms. There's like a tube, there's crystals and like a suction machine, and you blast the face with the crystals, and then the tube sucks the crystals and the dead skin off, and it goes back into like a cylinder. They were reusing it. When I say they, I mean in the medical dermatology community, people were reusing crystals. So what was happening was Lauren would go in and get it done. I would go in, get it done, but I'm getting all of her germs, her dead. I mean, it sounds disgusting and crazy now, but like this was pre-AIDS. This was like, you know, like this was a different time. And there started to be a lot of backlash about that. And that was kind of like the aha moment for him. And that is when he created, which to this day is still our hero and one of our top selling products. The first product that really kind of, you know, sparked the idea in our heads to build a brand off of that hero product. And that was our Dr. Scrub, our cult product. And when he created this product for his patients, for my mom, you know, we're using it and he was just sort of testing it and trying it and people were freaking out over it. They loved it. It was better than microdermabrasion in the office. You know, he was able to add hydrating emollients to it. So it was different than just going in and getting a procedure. You were getting like a little, it was like a multifunctional product, right? And word sort of began to travel. And, you know, at the time, my brother and I were quite young. And then fast forward to my brother being in college, he had this scrub, you know, in his you know, I think it was his freshman, sophomore year or something. And all of his friends would steal the scrub. Everyone was obsessed with the scrub. All of my girlfriends love the scrub. So, you know, a few years after that, when he graduated college, he kept getting these calls from his friends being like, oh my God, we need that scrub. Like, how can we get your dad's scrub? And it wasn't available anywhere because we didn't have a brand. I mean, this was made for his patients and for family. It wasn't, you know, the idea of this, of the doctor brand hadn't really exploded yet. So that was kind of like the, huh, we really, really have something here. And like, what can we build onto each side of that hero product and look at, you know, the reasons why people go to their dermatologist? I mean, there's really only probably a handful, maybe 8 real reasons why people go to their dermatologist. And they're pretty even across the board, whether you're a man, you're a woman, you know, whatever color, it doesn't matter. You know, your skin is skin. And most people suffer from very similar issues. So, you know, figuring out what people are coming in for, that's the problem. And then figuring out the solution, right? That's the product, that's the active ingredients, that's the plant-based, you know, ingredients that he spends, you know, most of his time now researching and, you know, formulating and playing around with and trying to get something that really, you know, fits or fills like a bucket, you know, that's, we can talk about that later, like when we're, you know, coming up with new product ideas and product development. So that's kind of how that happened. And then Lauren, I'll let her talk about how she kind of then pivoted in, but that was kind of the impetus for really building out this brand.
And at that point, did you guys start, did your brother start exploring launching it as a business at that point?
He was working in Wall Street, hated it, and wanted to do something more entrepreneurial and had this idea like, Dad, we should build products. Like, people love them. And you have all these patients that have been coming to you for years and years and years. Why don't we do something? And there's nothing on the market. At that time, there were a couple dermatologists that had some lines, but there was nobody that was truly bridging the gap between clean and effective and physician strength beauty, or skincare specifically. And Lisa and Rob's father said, you know, I'm not a business guy. I'm a doctor. I'll help you if you want to do this. And so that sort of really began our journey. I was working investment bank hours, banking hours at Crisp and Porter, and was traveling all the time. I was burnt out. And I just remember one day sitting at my desk thinking to myself, I am absolutely killing myself, destroying myself with this computer to sell a car. At that point, I was working on Volkswagen, and I wanted to go to the other side. And so I decided to just take this leap of faith, and I'm so happy that I did. That was 11 years ago. And that really sort of started our journey. And that journey was equally thrilling as it was scary. Because, you know, when you're building a brand, you feel, and I'm going to talk internally, that you have this incredible idea, right? That is just, that we're filling a white space in the market. We have defined what it is. There is a need for these products. Now we have to find someone who equally believes in us and can bring this vision to life. And so really my role was to find at the time a design agency, particularly one that specialized in beauty, that saw and shared in our passion and our vision. And that was one thing I learned in working at a big agency. And that was one of the things you wanted me to talk about, was I realized that if you could create sort of this cult-like community of people that just loved what they did and believed in it, it didn't matter. Like, they would work their hardest. They would give you their best work. And so it took us a while, actually. I think we interviewed at least a dozen different agencies, and we ended up hiring an agency out here in Los Angeles called Hatch Beauty, and just fell in love with the team there. And it was a gruesome 2-year-long process. And when I say that is, you know, when you start a brand, we actually had something that we brought to the table, and that was a handful of formulas, but they weren't packaged. You know, there was no naming system. There was no visuals. And I think that at that time, we had seen, specifically in the beauty industry, this natural movement completely fail. And people looked at it as that was like Whole Foods. They've done it. It's over. People don't like those type of products. That pumpkin enzyme mask, it like goes, rancid after a couple of days. And clean beauty, which is so ironic to where we are today, is like the biggest category in beauty. But at that time, it was, okay, how are we going to come in, modernize clean beauty or natural, and also communicate that this is a doctor? So it was really taking these two worlds of physicians' strength, problem solution based skincare that was being product. We're making products that really were designed to mimic in office treatments, yet we weren't formulating with what we really deem as harsh skin irritants, a lot of the chemicals that are on sort of the nasty list, and bring that marriage together in a playful, modern, but also digestible way, so that people could understand and they, could digest the information. So there was so much that went into sort of developing this range. And what we did at that time simultaneously was also figure out, okay, well, where do we want this to live? Like, what is our distribution strategy? Because that was almost equally as important as the branding was, because we knew that we needed to align ourselves, partners, just like we did with our design agency, that also shared in our passion and our belief system, so that we could tell that story and really stay on that path. Because we knew if we got off the path, beauty is one of those industries that you could chase trends. And really, you've seen brands over and over and over do it again, is that they lose their DNA, their soul. And we knew that we had to do both, one, the creative aspect of it, and two, the distribution strategy, in order to really be successful.
I feel like you probably also were an extremely, I don't mean this in a bad way, difficult client to work with, in the sense that I'd imagine demand great work out of a design agency coming from your background.
I think so, but I also think that's why we picked the agency that we ended up with, because they were, that team was so brilliant and so good at what they did. And they had, they had a track record of other brands that they were building. And they knew that this was going to be the biggest opportunity and the biggest challenge in the same way. And it ended up being such a great marriage, really.
How did you go about finding and interviewing the design agencies to find somebody like that? And then also, I feel like there's a great level of patience that you'd have to have, while also feeling some sense of urgency to bring the idea into the world.
It's actually a great question. And I think we learned that a little bit along the way. It started with identifying, at the time, there were a handful of fairly well-known beauty-specific design agencies. Of course, they grappled in, consumer goods. And so I think it was first starting with that sort of subset of groups, interviewing them, meeting with them. And I think if we've learned anything throughout business, I would say anyone in any category, they know that it's all about relationships, and it's about, melding with people and sharing and sort of the same visions and passions. And so I think fairly quickly we identified if someone was a good fit or not a good fit, and vice versa. And then it was toying with, do we hire an agency? Do we go with a small, little design group or a one designer? And so it took a while. I think we were on a I don't even know, an interview path for at least 3 or 4 months. And then when we finally, landed, it was one of our last meetings. It was a last minute referral. And we said, you know what? Okay, we'll meet it. And it, at that time, it just clicked. We left that meeting saying, this is who we need to be working with. So I think sometimes it's just about trusting your gut a little bit. And I think at the time we wanted to make this, that it was right, that we didn't want to make a mistake and go with the wrong person or come up with the creative that we would have to rebrand in a handful of years. So this is, we really were putting so much time and investment and money into this that we were willing to sacrifice on a timeline.
And I also feel like at the time, even now, it's somewhat unique to have a doctor-backed brand that also has a natural focus.
Yeah.
Is do you think that that's still true today?
Oh, and, yes.
And what do you think about your dad attracted him to that lifestyle and that path?
Yeah, I definitely, it is still true today. And I feel like we have seen a lot of brands who have sort of tried to emulate that. But for the most part, you know, when we came on the scene, and we always look back now fondly about it, but like at the time we were kind of like, I mean, people didn't really know kind of what to do with us, which Lauren, you know, touched on earlier. Like it was such a new category and we were kind of like the only player in the category, right? So like there were your doctor high and high performance brands, and then there were your very natural, you know, brands that really had hit the ground running, like I'd say in, you know, 2008, 2009, but like that category did not take off the way it was supposed to. It's certainly not the way it is, you know, now. And for us, you know, and I remember with this was a conversation a lot with the branding company, you know, about what the name of the brand was going to be and like how, you know, we had to, of course, visually as well as with our brand DNA, you know, express the fact that we are natural, but primarily, I mean, we are still a doctor brand, right? So like the MD at the end of our name was, that was why that was chosen. It was kind of like, you know, great, this is healthy and it's clean and it looks, you know, elevated and green and white, but like, don't make a mistake. Like this is very effective physician strength, high performance skincare.
And also with the celebration that a dermatologist is the highest level of skin knowledge in, you know, in terms of a professional that exists. So really celebrating and owning that space.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in terms of the distribution strategy, like what did it look like getting the brand launched and off the ground? And where did you initially find some traction that led to kind of breaking the door open in terms of the natural space in general?
Sure. So this is, we're talking 2013 when we started taking our meetings, and my gosh, we were in so many meetings and people said, your brand is just beautiful, but this is not going to work. This is natural is done. It's over. It was a trend. And we desperately wanted to be in Space NK. Space NK was founded by a woman who still to this day is our mentor, Nikki Kennard, who has been in the beauty industry for decades. And she has really been celebrated as a woman who finds sort of the best in global beauty and brings it to one retail space. And they have about 75 locations in the UK, in London. And she had just launched her brand in the US and they had opened a couple of stores, and we wanted to be there because we knew that we would drown in a very large distribution store right off the gate because we weren't going to be big enough to be able to put the money behind the marketing, and the retailers wouldn't give us the time to tell our story, and we essentially had zero customers. So we had to create the desire, the want, and the buzz. And there was no better retailer at the time to do that than with Space NK. So we finally got a meeting. I remember that our buyer looked at us dead straight in the face and said, I am going to try this. I'm going to test it in 5 doors and it's not going to work. And here's your sales goal. You have to meet this sales goal. You know, and so we said, we're going to prove you wrong. It's going to work. And we tripled our sales goal in, I think, the first 3 months. So that was October we launched with them. And by February of 2014, we were launching into 50 of their doors in the UK.
How did you guys triple the sales goal? Did you like tactfully do something that created more momentum for you? Was it the education background that like led you guys to be more hands-on than other brands that were in the same retail set?
Yes. And I also think that we believed so much in this brand and the positioning. There was nothing like it there. And we went and we did extensive training, to your point, and we had sort of an incredible training experience, but we got the associates excited about this brand. We had gone out and we had hired a fairly large PR team to make sure that we had the PR to support this new launch. We had events, you know, so it was like we had sort of this like very large approach to make sure that we were not going to mess this up and we were going to support this. And we knew that if we could just get the associates, the team members at these stores on board with us, that we would have a home run. And we did, because there was nothing within this space. You know, we attract that consumer who is getting sort of the latest treatments in his or her, you know, office, whether that be your facialist or your plastic surgeon or your dermatologist. Yet when it comes time to what that person wants to use on their skin, they're very familiar with ingredients and they want to feel good about using, you know, sort of clean, good for you products. And so we knew that this was our consumer. This was that customer who shops there. They were savvy. They understood skincare. They were getting those treatments, yet there was nothing. They were also secretly buying, you know, these, you know, sort of brands with chemicals in them because there was no other alternative.
And also, we were able to be incredibly hands-on, A, because we wanted to be, and we really believed in this so much. And, you know, B, I mean, it was just us. I mean, yeah, we hired the PR firm, but I mean, you know, Lauren and I, we stood, I mean, for the first like 2 years, I mean, we serviced those doors. I mean,
we were on planes, trains, buses, we were everywhere.
I mean, I didn't have a sales team in New York City at that time. I think I had one person helping. I mean, I was, you know, going to any Bloomingdale's that would let me go in and work. And as was Lauren on the West Coast, I mean, we were kind of like doing it literally, with pleasure. But I also think that in the beginning, and even now, because that comes back into like being able to tell your story and really share your passion with your customer, you know, people just like they want to meet a founder. They want to talk to you. They want to understand why you created this and what it means and what it's about and why this and, you know, why avocado oil instead of, you know, almond or whatever. Like there is a great opportunity in that. And I think because we were so small in a medium-sized pond at the time, you know, it was really kind of a blessing in disguise that we were given, like we had to do it and we did it with love, but like it ended up working in our favor because I think that people really saw the brand as, you know, these two young women and the dermatologist father and father-in-law. And like, you know, we really built that piece by piece. And I think in like people want that. They want to see that.
And nowadays too, and again, we've had such a fast-paced evolution of our consumer habits. But, you know, I would say when we first launched, now every brand is doing it. Not every brand was talking about life beyond a product or a service that they were selling. And we had so much more to say. You know, we were, yes, we were selling products, but we were also advising people of, you know, you need to be sleeping and you're probably, you know, skincare is a very personal thing. And I think that when you start to talk to people, it's like you become their therapist, because if you have skin issues, it is very debilitating. And when you're helping somebody, you're doing nothing more than boosting their confidence in their world, you know? So it becomes this very personal connection and relationship. And so we were having these, you know, in-depth conversations with people all over the world at this point, and really creating a community and a cult-like following, which is really what helped us, you know, get the growth that we've had.
It's funny because I feel like a lot of, super successful entrepreneurs talk about the early days of being on the ground and doing the education and talking and meeting people and being the direct line of contact and communication and ultimately like hustling their way to success. And I feel like nowadays with the realm of like venture capital and maybe faster development and faster growth ideas or visions, I always find it funny that like the simplest thing that you possibly could do is the one that led you guys to create momentum and success. Now with the change and what the way people are shopping and everything that's happening with COVID, have you guys transferred over any of like those initial learnings with the brand and education into the way that you do things online?
Yeah. And it's such a good question, because I think you just hit the nail on the head, and it's having that personal understanding and relationship of your audience. You know, just to go back a tad, so much there was the hustle of, you know, being on the ground, but it also gave us so many ideas too, because we heard what people needed and wanted. And I think when you have nowadays, you can't exist without having a digital component of your brand, no matter what, you know, industry you're in, right? But I think the brands that have been able to have success are those that can create a story and can create a connection, whether that be in fashion or in beauty. You know, you have to be able to do that. So how can you find personalization in a world that has an interface, you know? And so we have shifted so much in COVID, but done so in a really thoughtful way to try to bring through the personality, you know, on screen. So, you know, I can share examples if that's helpful. But yes, I mean, I think yes.
I would love to hear some examples. I just think it's interesting. Like, I've been thinking about. I think everything starts as a small business, like in a way, or it should. Like, you're a small brand in the beginning. You should act as though you're a small brand in order to grow in the future. And I feel like a lot of founders get lost in the idea of becoming bigger than they are currently. So they veer off from like the most basic things that are true throughout all of human nature, like that connecting on a personal and human level creates a deeper sense of loyalty, and they actually want to do business with you over time because they know who you are, they know what you're about, they know why you did something beyond just the product. And people get lost in the idea of like larger strategies or thinking that they're smarter than they might even need to be. And so I'm curious how you've kind of brought the same thinking into the digital space, knowing that it's filled with like these hacks or strategies, and like how you can skip X, Y, and Z step to get to your ultimate goal and how you've kind of like created your own path, maybe through that?
There's two ways that I think we look at that as a brand and as a business. The first is very simplistic communication. So when COVID hit, we launched a couple different things that were new to us in the digital space, but we offered free one-to-one Zoom consultations to our clients who, you know, wanted help and advice in a time of complete sort of disarray, which has been really successful and has allowed for us to continue that personal relationship. And the other thing, you know, I think using the digital world and the landscape to our advantage. So we were able to pivot very quickly to do various, you know, sort of digital events, whether it be, you know, taking a larger group on a facial regimen and how to elevate and, you know, sort of enhance your facial at home and what to do. And we did that with our community. We partnered with retailers. We partnered with, you know, sort of various communities to do that, which has been really successful. I think we were surprised, Lisa, mm-hmm. about sort of the attendance and the, you know, everyone's talking about Zoom fatigue, but I think when people are really engaged and interested in learning about something, you have real success stories. And then I would say on a branding level, it has pivoted and changed in a way that we are doing so many more brand collaborations to tell a deeper story about, you know, sort of who is GoldFat and who are we aligning with? Let's tell the story of healthy looking skin, or let's tell the story of how to clear your congestion through, you know, various different avenues with not just topically, but let's talk about ingestibles and let's bring in sleep experts to talk about the importance of sleep. And so really sort of aligning ourselves with experts or other brands has been really successful and important for us as a brand to grow. And also to align with tastemakers and influencers that tell and showcase real stories. So taking somebody who may have a large following or community and documenting their experience with using GoldFat in a real authentic way and celebrating, you know, men and women, you know, of different varieties and communities, I think has also been something that we've focused a lot on because the digital landscape is there for us and it has such a broad scope reach. Anything else, Lee? I would say that's sort of top level.
Yeah. No, you hit it.
Another question I have, somewhat out of selfish reasons, is it seems like you guys run a very proactive organization. Like you, when COVID hit, you took very proactive and immediate measures to try and connect with people directly. Like from the outside looking in, there wasn't like a long delay in terms of trying to find your way. And also doing that within a family business seems like it would be even more challenging. How do you manage your own mindsets in terms of trying to create the positive outcomes that you want and then also communicating those things in a family-run business?
Great questions.
so many answers.
So many answers. I mean, first and foremost, you know, I think it's a double-edged sword, right? So being a family business has, of course, more pros than cons, but understanding, you know, the family dynamic, understanding who wears what hat when. We've been doing this long enough that Lauren and I mean, people call us by the other one's name. We finish each other's sentences. Like we really kind of, you know, can be operating, you know, under one brain, the two of us. But I think you know, for us, a rule we have, like just talking about the family aspect of it, is that we have always, from the very beginning, been very clear about being able to separate, you know, business from the friendship, from the family. And, but we had to work on it. It wasn't like, it was just sort of like, okay, you know, it could be something as silly as like, we're not going to talk about business after, you know, 6 PM. Like, we're not going to talk about it unless there's an emergency. We're not talking about it. Like, we then go into like family mode. My parents have always been like that with us, even as children. Like, it was kind of like, when it's dinner time, like, we talk about family and whatever. We're not talking about like, you know, my dad's crazy job or whatever. And then I also think, you know, for us in early March, when this was coming down the pipeline, it was kind of like, you know, how do you, this is real, like, this is happening. The world is changing and has changed. Our business is going to change. Everything, our industry is going to change. And how are we going to protect our brand, protect ourselves, protect our customers, still be able to give them what they need, what they want? And it also has to do with, you know, the team that we've built internally, that we're lucky enough, we have such an incredible internal team, and allowing, and then of course, working with and hiring people that are also proactive, that also have the same type of mindset. And then you build this little, it's like a family inside of a family. And that's what, you know, these few people are, and that are, you know, with us and day to day, and particularly, you know, like manning up the, you know, helping us with everything, social media, everything, marketing, you know, it takes more than just two people. You know, there's a few of us. It's like having,
I think one thing that we did very well also is really identifying, and what we've always done, we put a plan in place and really stuck to it, which I think helps everybody. But being a small team and a smaller scale business sort of allows for you to identify those immediate problems and get through them to move to the next step. I think sometimes when you're part of such a large team or a bigger corporation, you don't have control over that sometimes, or there's too many cooks in the kitchen. And, you know, speaking specifically with COVID, you know, our first piece that we needed to tackle was to try and help and save our field team who works in stores with an industry that closed their doors, and figuring out who we could keep, what we could do to help them in their lives. And then also sort of, you know, yes, we're all here to be as business, you know, individuals and selling product, but also sort of humanizing us again. You know, what are people going through right now? What do they need? And let's talk their language. You know, let's not try to, you know, be selling, I'm just using this as an example, but, you know, a sunscreen when everyone's stuck inside, you know? So really, you know, creating a marketing plan that was a balance of the selling techniques, you know, that you can traditionally see, and lifestyle and added value for people, and, you know, having sort of a personalized touch. Maybe it was, you know, something that they could adapt in their life and resonate with what was happening with them at home.
Yeah.
And in terms of managing, just on a personal level, like going through such an uncertain time in business, and in your own personal life and family life too, I think I'm interested also, like, the perspective that you guys seem to have is very high level, somewhat like removed from the anxiety and stress of the day to day to make the best decisions possible long-term for the brand. How do you balance and manage yourself going from the high level to also running the day-to-day of a business that needs to generate revenue and support the team and take care of the people involved with the brand?
I was thinking about this today because if Lisa and I were talking about something completely unrelated, and I said to her, if we've learned anything through this entire, you know, pandemic, it's that you can't plan and you have to take things day by day. And you also have to really listen. And, you know, we were launching an entire new category during COVID, which is a two-piece body collection. And we were scheduled to do a shoot. You can't do shoots with models and, you know, a whole production crew during a pandemic. And so it was just, I mean, I think really, I can speak for our team, but just coming, being creative, like almost getting back to the creative aspect of the business, you know, taking time to find a way to meditate or like get some inspiration outside, but thinking about just being very creative thinkers of how are we going to make this work? Because we have this product, we have to sell it. And how can we get people to photograph themselves and, you know, with these at home? So I think it was sort of a little bit of not reacting so quickly, but at the same time, acting fast enough in order to get things done, just because the sources of information that were coming in on a daily basis were just so, I mean, we're in these pendulum swings, which we still are, but it bleeds over into everyone's business and personal lives. So I think really being thoughtful about the approach to, you know, conducting business was something that, you know, we were, I think, very top of mind for all of us.
Do you guys have ways that you've tried to really encourage the creative thinking, like especially now working mainly remotely, I'd assume, you know, like having and creating those conversations that get you out of the immediate stressful aspect of the situation and then reframing to think about ways that you can create better outcomes, I know is difficult in general, let alone when you're not in the same room.
We have lots of Zoom brainstorming calls with the two of us and then also with the other part, like our team. And sometimes it's really just, it may not even be talking about something specific, but it's just talking about, like, I remember we had one where everyone sort of filled out their document and we were trying to come up with the hashtag for our new body collection and what the call out was going to be. And like everyone, I think, cause we had all been, and this was a while ago now. So like we were still, I mean, I was locked inside, LA was locked. We were locked down. And so, I mean, we came up with some really creative things, all of us, like all five people. And then I remember we had a call about it and we were like, oh, we love this one. And we love that one. We love that one. So oddly enough, this sort of, this kind of, locked down alone time, I think lent itself to creativity. And I mean, I know so many people, friends, whomever, that have taken up all sorts of different creativity type hobbies just from having been, you know, in quarantine. And yeah, I mean, a lot of it really is just like conversations, Zooms, talking. I mean, I know for me, like I get my best ideas like when I'm outdoors exercising, and if I can't be outdoors, it's like indoors dancing. You know, like I danced in my apartment for weeks because I couldn't go anywhere.
Also look at the nature of what COVID has done for us. It's isolated all of us to the point that every single human being is looking for escapism and, you know, to find creative outlets. Me personally, I've never done more research and reading and podcasts. And my point is that this is the opportunity to really do some self-reflection that helps our lives before COVID. For every single one of us, were such fast paced that I think oftentimes you didn't have the opportunity or the chance to slow down and really think things thoroughly. And so I'm not surprised that I believe that our best work has been, you know, through COVID, and probably that's similar across the board in many other industries, because it has forced everyone to pause, to really think things through and come up and devise a plan that is really sort of filled with creativity, not just in the assets, but also sort of the approach, because you have one line only and that's digital.
Yeah. Personally, I feel like remote work is way better in all aspects for only really one reason. Like, if you ask me a question, which obviously I'm asking you a ton of questions over the past hour, but if you were to ask me a question in a business situation, especially if you're working for someone or for a group, essentially like an in-person meeting in most corporate settings, you're expected to like have an answer to something immediately, which can't be as good as the answer that you'd come up with if you actually took time to think and consider multiple options and then approach it again when you felt comfortable that you had found the best possible route to get through something.
Definitely. I would agree with that. I mean, I think at first everyone was kind of like, oh no, like remote working. I mean, since I live in New York City, like I work from home normally anyway. However, where I live, there's a coffee shop where I would go, you know, like, so even though I was kind of like already working remotely, it did change even more because there was nowhere to go. But there is this, because we had to slow down, exactly what you're saying, Sean and Lauren as well, it's almost like you have this gift of extra time, because everything's slowed and you are able to craft your ideas, craft your answers, really. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it sounds crazy to say it, but I mean, this is the way it is right now anyway. So I don't even know
that I'd say it sounds crazy to say it. I feel like most, business people are just worried. If they are scared to say that, they're worried about like the control aspect of things. But I think what you gain in that you lose maybe in control, or like the illusion that you have more control by seeing people physically working in your office, is far greater than just having people sit in the same room while they do things, in my opinion.
For sure. Yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much for taking the time to come on the show and also talk through the brand with me. It was super, super fun to learn how you guys started and all of the ideation behind the brand.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, Sean.
Red receipt.